The first, I think, as Representative Shetterly called it in the Revenue Committee today, the inaugural meeting of the House Judiciary Committee. We're certainly glad you're here and look forward to working with this committee through the coming legislative session. I want to welcome all our guests that are here in person and any of those that are joining us either through the system, the closed circuit system, or on the internet. And also want to take this opportunity to welcome our new members. We have some brand new legislative members that are serving for the first time in the legislature. Representative McPherson, want to welcome you to the committee. And Representative Barker, who isn't here with us yet, are new members. But we also have some new faces on the Judiciary Committee that are senior members of the body. And I want to welcome both Representative Crummell, Representative Jensen, and returning member Representative Prozanski. And I didn't mention Representative Anderson, who's our vice chair and is also serving his first session in the legislature. So appreciate you all being here. And it would make some sense now, I think, to introduce the committee staff to you new members that haven't had a chance to meet them yet, as well as to those that are here in the audience. So to my immediate left is Bill Taylor. Bill's been with the Assembly since January of 1987, formerly counsel to the United States Capitol Police, the 1,200-person police force that guards the Capitol in Washington, D.C. He was an attorney for the Federal Election Commission and has been in private practice in both Boston and in Portland. He's got a B.A. from Holy Cross and his J.D. from Suffolk University Law School and a master's in tax, which I didn't know until I had read this biography, a master's in tax from Georgetown University Law Center. So, Representative Shetterly, on the Revenue Committee, if there are tough issues, you can talk to Bill.
You bet.
Bill is married to Margaret Taylor. They have two daughters, ages 14 and 13, two dogs and one cat, and they live in Salem.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I don't have it's not a revenue question, but I did have a question about which box I should check on that per diem.
I'll talk to you after.
Oh, thank you.
Back in my office.
Also, Craig Prinz, down at this end of the table. Craig is also counsel to the committee. He grew up in Grants Pass and went to Grants Pass High School, went to college in Santa Barbara. He did law school at Notre Dame. Before we got Craig, he was a deputy district attorney in Multnomah County, handling criminal delinquency and dependency cases. He lives in Beaverton, and he's married to Natalie. And Craig, you've been... Craig staffed the 01 session as temporary counsel and then returned as permanent counsel to us in
April
of last year,
correct.
2002. And we're glad to have Craig. And then on this end of the dais, we have Bill Joseph. Bill was born and raised in Shaker Heights, Ohio, a suburb of Cleveland. He's got a B.A. in international relations from Boston University spent some time abroad as well. He's got his J.D. from George Washington University Law School. He's been employed in San Francisco. He worked 4 years for a civil litigation defense firm there. In the last 2.5 years, Bill's been at Bullivant Hauser Bailey, where he has taken a leave to assist us as session counsel. And we're thankful both to his law firm for letting him go and for Bill being down here with us. He's married to Joanna Lezak. They live in the Hillsdale area in southwest Portland with their dog Sedona. He plays rhythm guitar in a band, the name of which I can't pronounce.
Gajo Jazz.
There you go. Gajo Jazz. So that's our council committee staff. And now support staff. Patsy Wood. Raise your hand, Patsy. Patsy's our committee assistant for the House Judiciary Criminal Law Committee in 1999. She now is our office coordinator for both the House and Senate Judiciary Committees since September 1999. And it is Patsy who manages all the paper and makes it possible for us to do what we do, and we would be in trouble without her. Ann Martin. Stand up, Ann. Ann is returning to us. She was a 2001 committee assistant for House Judiciary. In 87, she was the copy editor with Legislative Council, and she spent three sessions in the Chief Clerk's office. And then Jane Bodenweiser. Jane is right there. Jane was 2001 committee counsel assistant or committee assistant for the Senate Judiciary Committee, and would sometimes spill in over here on the House where it was always more fun than the Senate, and we appreciate seeing Jane as well. So that's our committee staff, and I would encourage members and those watching as well to feel free to communicate with staff about any issues that you have, and certainly members, they're a very important resource as we move through our agenda. I have several others that I want to introduce that are going to be very critical to the committee that are sitting in the audience. Virginia Vanderbilt and C.J. Mills, if you two would stand up. There you go. There you go. Thank you very much. This is the legislative council team. Virginia is a deputy legislative counsel, does most of the drafting on bills related to criminal and juvenile matters, and C.J. is going to be working is your assistant or however that structure works, and they'll be spending a lot of time running up here when they've been watching us on TV and we're getting off track. Virginia will come up and help us get back on, and we appreciate that. And I also want to introduce Marty, and I'm going to mispronounce your name, Marty.
Sathoff.
Is it Sathoff?
Danny Santos will
yeah,
be introduced.
Danny,
he's doing the handoff.
Do you want to stand up? Danny Santos, former counsel to Governor Kitzhaber, is introducing now Marty. And did I get it right? Is it Sathoff?
Perfect.
Okay. And she is Governor Kulongoski's new counsel. We appreciate her being here today and look forward to having a great working relationship with the governor's office on matters that will be coming before the committee. Who else have I missed? Oh, Robin, where are you? Robin Lamont. That's Robin Lamont. Robin Lamont manages most of the judiciary issues from legislative fiscal office. So when we get bills that have a fiscal impact, more often than not, Robin will have prepared the fiscal impact and will be assisting the committee as we discuss some of those issues as they come through the process. And she sometimes will probably be tuning us in on TV from her office as well and wondering what the heck we could possibly be thinking. So we appreciate Robin being here. A couple of housekeeping issues for the committee from an agenda standpoint. These are sort of coming events. Because we weren't able to notice the meeting, we've rearranged the schedule slightly for yesterday's intended meeting. So tomorrow we will have a presentation by the Chief Justice and the Attorney General. The Chief Justice will be talking generally about the court system and the judicial branch, and the Attorney General will be generally giving us an overview of the Department of Justice. On Friday, January 17th, the committee will take a field trip to the Coffee Creek Correctional Facility. We have an option committee. We can either leave at 11:30 or leave at 12. They'll feed us prison lunch, and then they'll provide services, shuttle services for anybody who wants to come back to Salem. You can ride up and back if you want to get up there, and then as Representative Crummell can probably throw a rock from the facility and hit his house, he may not want to come back down later in the afternoon. But that is going on Friday, and we will need to know, communicate with staff your pleasure on transportation. And also there's some issues about not wearing blue jeans and some things like that that matter when you go inside a facility that we can go over and that they'll go over with you. Also, your staff is invited. So if for some reason, and I know, for example, Representative Anderson won't be able to attend, if he wants to send a staff person, he can. If you want to bring a staff person and come as well, you can bring a staff person as well. On Thursday, January 20th. Oh yeah, right. You need to bring adequate identification, which usually includes your driver's license.
In advance.
Okay. Well, the staff will take care of the security check information with you before Friday. But we need to know who's going, and so we can coordinate the vans and the shuttle back. On Thursday, January 23rd, we'll have Dr. Hill Walker here from the Institute on Violence and Destructive Behaviors of the University of Oregon about risk factors and program evaluation. On the 24th of January, which is a Friday, those of you on the committee, and I'd encourage your attendance if you could, there's a program at the University of Oregon Law School called Prisons Growth, Political, Economic, and Social Issues. Mr. Taylor is passing out the materials. We won't have a formal committee meeting that day, so if you do so you're freed up in the afternoon to attend that program, and I'd encourage your attendance. On Wednesday, January 28th, we're going to be spending time talking about the mentally ill in the criminal justice system, and this will be a presentation from some folks from the Council on State Governments that will be flying in to perform that. And then later in February, we'll have Ed Lasada of the University of Cincinnati on what works and what doesn't in the criminal justice system. Also on January 31st, we'll be doing another field trip to the Oregon Youth Authority facility, and I believe we're going to be going to which one?
Probably McLaren and maybe Albany.
Okay. The McLaren facility probably is where we'll be. Finally, there is and is this date still solid?
No, it's been moved back a week.
Okay.
Didn't get to that.
All right. So in early February, there will be a meeting where we'll be meeting jointly with the Public Safety Subcommittee of the Ways and Means Committee on mapping the public safety system. It's going to be 2 days probably of afternoon meetings. We'll meet in joint session with the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety, and it's going to be a very comprehensive discussion about public safety issues, both from the policy and from the fiscal and financial issues. It's probably one of the most critical meetings of those that I've outlined here, and I'd strongly encourage your attendance. So, Floyd, do you want to add something about the prison program?
Yeah, thank you,
program?
Mr. Chair. I guess I just want to make sure the members understand on this prison growth symposium that's going to be down at the University of Oregon at their law school. When you look at the registration form, it does note that if you want CLE credit, that there's a price for that. That is not the case for members, and I assume legislative staff as well. If you need CLE credit, that will be waived for members as well as I would assume for the attorney staffs.
So Representative Barker and Representative Crummell, it's a real bonus to you to get that continuing legal education credit.
I'll look forward to that, putting that on my report.
All kidding aside, I do want to say to our non-lawyer members of the committee that we appreciate their participation. As I've commented to most of you privately, you bring in a very important perspective to the committee, and by the time the session is over, you will think you're entitled to your diploma, whether you did or you didn't go to law school. We do appreciate your involvement.
Mr. Chair, is it possible to just challenge the bar in Oregon? Or
you know,
is
it's not.
The only state
there are some states you can do that, Representative Crummell, but Oregon still requires you to graduate from an accredited law school. Although Karen Garza, our executive director from the Oregon State Bar, is in the back of the room, and if you'd like to talk to her about changing those rules, I'm sure she'd be happy to chat with you after the meeting. Okay. We are now to the point of the agenda before we move on to the substantive discussions we're going to be having today to the adoption of the rules. In the materials in front of you, you should have
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I may interrupt you momentarily,
mm-hmm.
All of those dates and times that you went over, are we going to receive some kind of a memo that has all of those on there, or should we have been writing terribly fast?
Representative Crummell, I can assure you that staff will publish a more detailed schedule. A couple of these dates were still in flux, but a more detailed schedule with these events will be provided to each of the members and posted as well for the public in the next day or so.
Thank you.
All right. We are at the process of adoption of the rules. You have in front of you the rules of the committee. They are essentially the same version that is used in virtually every committee in the building and that we have used previously. Are there any? Thank you, too, for coming, by the way. Is there any discussion on the rules before we move towards their adoption? All right. The chair would entertain a motion on the rules.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I move that we adopt the proposed rules on Committee on Judiciary for the 72nd Legislative Assembly as published.
Representative Crummell moves that we adopt the rules that are before the committee for the House Committee on Judiciary for the 72nd Legislative Assembly. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, the rules are adopted. And we do have, colleagues, several bills. We'll now move to the issue a bill introduction. We have several bills. You'll notice that in the green sheets over the last several days, there have been a number of bills that were introduced by the Joint Interim Judiciary Committee. A number of those have been assigned already, and we'll be moving through the process. But we have four, I think. Is that right, Council?
Yes.
Four,
I
is
have
it five?
Five.
There are five. And so typically what we do for those new members who may not have been involved in bill introduction, introducing a bill as a committee bill and your assent to a bill being introduced as a committee bill in no way implies your further assent or your support of the bill, your endorsement of the bill, or a commitment that you'll vote either for it or against it as the bill moves through the process. It's simply a process by which we can introduce bills as committee bills, but you retain your ability to amend, vote against, vote for, speak out, or whatever else you'd like to do with respect to that bill once the bill's been printed and assigned. It's also no guarantee, by the way, that any bill introduced actually gets assigned to our committee. That's an issue that's left, obviously, to the discretion of the Speaker and the Speaker's office. So with that, I'll have Council just briefly discuss the bills for bill introduction.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, LC 1187 authorizes the Office of Emergency Management to establish a program that credentials health care professionals for the purposes of voluntary services during an emergency. This came out of a work group during the interim as a result of an analysis done by the Governor's Office and the Attorney General's offices after the December 11th. Terrorist attack, an analysis of our law where there are gaps and holes and where we need to address the issue. This is one of them. Chair, members of the committee, LC 1308 limits tort liability of employer or principal with certain intentional acts of employer or agent to situations where employer has certain knowledge about employer or agent and fails to take reasonable steps to prevent the commission of a tort. If I remember correctly, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this is the same as the bill last session that passed the House and the Senate but was vetoed by the governor. It addresses
passed the House and the Senate, I think. Either in 99 or 01.
It might have been
in 99 when it happened.
Chair, members of the committee, LC 1783 authorizes Department of Corrections, Intergovernmental Corrections Entities, Counties, and Cities to contract with private prison providers provision of correctional services. Right now, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, most of the services, the prison's contract, the Department of Corrections contracts, most of a considerable amount of its services now, arguably it could enter into a contract with a private prison provider. However, there would be certain ambiguities, particularly as it relates to such issues of the authority of the prison employees to apprehend someone. It's similar to a bill that was filed about 6 or 7 years ago.
Mr. Chair, where is that one originating from?
Yes. Mr. Chairman of the committee, there's a group working on issues as it relates to public safety, and this issue was raised at that time, a whole group of people. I can't specifically state who it was, but it's one of those issues that was raised.
Okay.
It's part, Mr. Chairman of the committee, it's part of the group that we've got going with the Ways and Means Committee.
Right.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, 1784 authorizes Oregon Youth Authority to contract with private providers for provision of youth corrections services. It's similar to the other bill. And then finally, Mr. Chair, 1807 expands authority of reserve officers.
Is this also out of the work group?
This one?
Yeah.
Chair, members of the committee. No, I think this came in from a reserve officer.
Yeah, this bill was requested, I think, Representative Persinski, by the Reserve Police Officers Association.
Thank you.
And I don't know that they cared. It was just easier to have it introduced as a committee bill. I don't know that they particularly cared one way or the other. Any discussion on those, colleagues? Again, this is introduction for introduction and printing purposes only. Again, your assent does not include... infer support of any of the bills that are presented. Hearing none, then the chair would move that LC 1783, 1308, 1784, 1187, and 1807 be introduced as committee bills. Any objection? Bill introduction complete. Okay, that takes us to the next part of our meeting, which is an informational meeting that we're going to be having on the issues involving indigent defense. We've got several panels that we'll ask to come up. I want to preface, that with just a couple of comments, colleagues, for those of you who might not have been following this issue. There was substantial over the five special sessions reductions made to the indigent defense budget. This is the first meeting of several that this committee will have throughout the course of the session addressing issues involving indigent defense services. There are issues that are going to be transition issues as the new system for indigent defense takes over. There are also going to be a number of issues about how the system operates that this committee is going to be reviewing. We were able in the last e-board meeting to get an additional allocation from the e-board of $5 million to assist in indigent defense operations. That allocation we'll hear today, I think, probably will tell you that it's not enough for them to operate fully for the remainder of the biennium, which means when they can't appoint counsel, there will be certain crimes which we will not be able to prosecute. This is going to be an ongoing issue and an ongoing problem as we deal with the impacts of the budget on public safety issues, and this is sort of our first introductory opportunity to get up to speed on that issue, to have a conversation about what right to counsel means, the provisions and how we operate that here within the state of Oregon. We'll have some discussion from Ann Christian about the indigent defense budget. We'll have some discussion as well from folks from the Attorney General's office in Multnomah County. If you can't appoint counsel in certain cases like post-conviction and dependency matters, and then finally we'll hear from George Reamer of the Oregon State Bar about whether or not you can draft a lawyer against his will or without payment. Maybe it's not against his will, but certainly without payment to provide indigent defense. And Mr. Reamer's with he's the general counsel for the Oregon State Bar. So with that, I'm going to invite Peter Ozan, who is the new executive director of the Office of Public Defense Services, to come forward. Mary Williams, Solicitor General from the Department of Justice, and Mike Livingston, Deputy Attorney General from the Appellate Division of DOJ, to come forward as well. And I don't see...
Mike just walked in.
And if you need to bring up an extra chair, feel free. Oh, and Jennifer Lloyd, I'm sorry.
Mr. Chair, with your permission, I will allow Mr. Livingston to have my chair and come up next.
All right, that's fine. If you've orchestrated this the way you'd like, I'm happy to hear it however you want to present it. Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Mr. Chair, as I indicated earlier, and by sheer coincidence, I have an appearance in Lane County Circuit Court at 3:30 this afternoon, so I'm going to excuse myself at this time with your permission. I want to do that now rather than just walk out during your testimony, which I'm sure is important to all of us. So thank you for the accommodation this afternoon.
You bet, Representative Ackerman. We understand that. Yes, Representative Sherrill.
I want to tell Representative Ackerman, good luck, and if you lose, I'll co-sponsor your bill.
I'll be back, counsel.
Okay. Who wants to lead off? Mike, is that you?
Actually, Mr. Mary? Chair, members okay. of the committee, I'm Mary Williams. I'm the Solicitor General for the Oregon Department of Justice. And with your permission, we have rearranged the items on the agenda a bit. I have a couple of comments I'd like to make, and then Jennifer Lloyd, who's the newly appointed assistant solicitor, is going to walk through the six different steps that are involved in the criminal process and explain with each of those steps what the right to counsel is, what happens, who's involved in those steps. Michael Livingston will talk about the juvenile dependency process and what the right to counsel is, both for parents and for children at the different points in that process. And then we're available to answer any questions that the committee may have. In your materials, you should also have materials from Ann Christian, including a yellow sheet that is a handy sort of summary table of the right to counsel for different kinds of cases and at different points in the process, and whether that's based on constitution or statute. Also in your materials, there's a report again, that Ann Christian has provided to you from, it's a report to the November 1994 e-board on the right to counsel that has some additional useful information about these topics. Before Jennifer starts talking about the steps in the criminal process, I just wanted to make a couple of points. First of all, when you're looking at changes in this process and you're looking at especially the role of indigent defense, it's critical to understand that we're talking about a system. and that changes in any one area can have unintended and sometimes very costly impacts on other parts of the system. And I know, Chair Williams, you mentioned the mapping project and the presentations that will be done with that. I think you're going to hear this from us and others repeatedly, that it's important to look at the agencies and the people who are involved in these systems, not in isolation, but as part of this larger process. We have unfortunate experience that there can be changes made looking for ways to create savings for the state, and if they're not carefully thought through in terms of the impacts they may have elsewhere in the system, they can actually result in increased cost to the state. One good example of that is what happened with changes in the judicial review process for parole board orders. In 1993, the legislature, in trying to save some money for the state, removed those orders from direct appeal, direct review of those orders. And what happened to all of those cases is that they then shifted to state habeas, which simply added another layer of review for cases that they were actually trying to expedite and to streamline. So instead of going from the parole board to the Court of Appeals, those cases then moved from the parole board to the state habeas trial courts and then to the Court of Appeals. Last legislative session, the legislature basically undid what had happened in 93 and moved those orders back to direct review. So one of the things we want to try to keep reminding us and others is that this is a system, and we have to look for the implications of where we may make some changes so that we're not simply shifting costs to other parts of the system. Another thing I'd like to point out is that for the system to work, all parts of the system must be working, or you simply shift the duties from one part of the system to another part. And usually that, I believe, is at increased cost for the system as a whole. As a general matter, we find that it's more efficient and less costly to have attorneys involved in cases than to allow individuals to proceed pro se or without counsel. So even in places where the Constitution may not require the appointment of counsel for indigent individuals, it may be less costly for the state to have counsel appointed. Cases where individuals are acting on their own typically are more complicated and take longer to resolve, both for the Department of Justice and for the courts. And it may be that the legal issues are not more complex in those cases, but simply getting the cases through the system often is at increased cost when you don't have attorneys involved, and especially when you don't have attorneys involved who specialize in the work that they do and know what it is that they're doing and have sort of built in their own efficiencies about how to handle the work that they're doing. Finally, I want to mention that over the past several years, we've participated in work groups looking at these questions and whether there are changes that could be made that would lead to savings for the state. And to be honest, we haven't come up with anything that's going to be a significant fix that's going to actually reduce costs for the state as a whole and not simply shift costs to other parts of the system. But we are committed to working together to find ways of being more efficient, and there may be additional changes that we can make internally and working with the courts that will enable us to make better use of our limited resources. And we'll continue to be working with indigent defense and with the court system to find ways of making some of those internal changes to be more efficient with the resources we have. But we haven't found areas where we can suggest to you statutory changes that are going to result in significant savings. And in large part, that's because of the constitutional requirements that are placed on this system and because of the interconnectedness of each of the steps of the system. And with that as some background, I'll turn this over to Jennifer Lloyd to talk about the steps of the criminal system and what's involved at each of those steps.
Thank you, Mary. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Jennifer Lloyd. I'm the Assistant Solicitor General. We've provided you with a small packet of material that's entitled Oregon Department of Justice Criminal Appeals. The text of this I don't want you necessarily to focus on now. It contains most of the information that I'm going to be giving to you. However, I think the graphic on the back will be helpful as we go through this. There are, as you can see from the graphic, I'm sorry. They're still coming around. There are a number of steps that are involved or that can be involved in a criminal case. As you can see from the graphic, we start on the left-hand side with the criminal conviction itself. That is the trial court proceeding. After that, there is an appeal, a direct appeal to the Court of Appeals as a matter of right, and then what is called discretionary review to the Oregon Supreme Court. The criminal defendant may ask the Supreme Court to review the Court of Appeals decision. The Supreme Court does not have to say yes, but the defendant is entitled to ask. And after that, we've got two other layers of proceedings. One is in state court, the post-conviction challenges to conviction, and then finally, any federal challenges that will happen in federal court. In the state court proceedings, in the direct, in the trial proceeding, in the where the criminal conviction actually comes from, the defendant has a constitutional right to counsel. And that extends all the way through the Court of Appeals and the Oregon Supreme Court. That's under the Oregon Constitution. Now, the defendant can also ask the United States Supreme Court to review federal issues that might arise. However, that's very rare for that even to happen. But throughout that layer of proceedings, the criminal defendant does have a constitutional right to court-appointed counsel if that person cannot afford a lawyer. And the guidelines for indigency are established by the Judicial Department. Now, the post-conviction proceeding, that second layer of state proceedings, is a statutory proceeding that's created by Oregon statute, and the statutes provide for court-appointed counsel for anyone who can't afford counsel, again, pursuant to the guidelines established by the Judicial Department. Now, the claims that are raised in that state post-conviction proceeding are claims that cannot be raised on direct appeal. The most common example are claims that my lawyer, throughout this first layer of proceedings, was constitutionally inadequate. Now, in that state post-conviction proceeding, the Department of Justice defends the conviction. And as I said, since the defendant has a statutory right to counsel, he or she will generally be represented by somebody from Public Defense Services or another lawyer appointed by the courts. The Post-Conviction Act, Hearing Act, was established to provide a uniform procedure for people to be able to challenge their convictions. Before that was in existence, the defendants proceeded through a number of different possible procedural mechanisms, which were confusing and time-consuming, and that is why we have this state statutory procedure for raising those challenges that can't be raised on direct appeal. Now, as Mary said, although the statutory right to post-conviction relief or to be able to pursue post-conviction relief or the statutory right to counsel could be eliminated, one of our big concerns is the expense of and complexity of dealing with post-conviction. Excuse me. I've got some cold medicine effects going on. Of dealing with people who are not represented by counsel. What that can lead to is procedural problems within the case, delays. And it can also often shift the burden of figuring out what the post-conviction claims are to both the Department of Justice, who is defending the case, and also to the courts, who are trying to figure out, does this claim have any merit? What do we have to decide here?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Crummell.
May I ask a question?
You may.
I'm curious about the post-conviction challenge, and I want to make sure that I heard you correctly. Being able to be to raise issues that were not that could not be raised on direct appeal, doesn't this sort of give the opportunity for a person that's been convicted to basically appeal this thing until hell freezes over?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, that is one of the criticisms that we hear about the multiple layers of proceedings that can be involved. The problem is it's almost necessary to have that separate layer of proceedings. It sounds like your concern is possibly, is there any way that all of the issues could be litigated in the same set of proceedings? And the problem is with that, the issues that are raised in post-conviction often just cannot be litigated in the first set of proceedings. For example, like I said, the best example is inadequate assistance of counsel in these proceedings. And
if they don't have adequate counsel, then that becomes a constitutional issue anyway. And wouldn't that be part of the direct appeal as in terms of any constitutional issues that are going to be raised?
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, let me take a shot at an answer first on this. One of the biggest differences between these two parts of the system have to do with what the record is. And on the direct appeal, what you have is the record that was created in the trial court, and that's all you have. So you have the evidence that came in, you have the testimony that was presented, and the record on the direct appeal is limited to what was created in the criminal process itself. So you don't have much else to go on for the kinds of issues that are going to be raised in a post-conviction process. And one of the reasons it starts over again at the state trial court level is to enable us to create a new record on those issues. When you're talking about adequacy of trial counsel or appellate counsel, then typically the kind of record that we're creating in the post-conviction process has to do with things including depositions from the attorney to find out what sort of choices were you making, why did you make them, depositions from the petitioner at that point in the process, what do you think your attorney should have done, and if what the petitioner thinks is that the attorney was inadequate for failing to talk to these three witnesses, for example, who would have provided an alibi, then a new record has to be created, because not only do we have to find out at that point, was the attorney adequate, or did the attorney do something wrong, but also was there any harm to the defendant for what the attorney failed to do? And that involves creating a whole new record, and so the process really does sort of start over again. The other thing about splitting it out into two different proceedings like this, we can limit some issues that can be raised on direct appeal. For example, if someone pleads guilty, then there's only a very narrow set of issues that they can seek review on through the appellate process. And that actually moves those cases along much more quickly than to try to also at the same time combine these other issues where we don't really have, it would be more complicated to develop the record at that point in the process. Another significant difference for us is that the burden of proof, the burden of persuasion shifts between the two proceedings. So in the direct appeal, the state is still defending the criminal conviction, and it's a criminal process. Post-conviction is actually a civil proceeding with a different standard of proof, a lower standard of proof, and the defendant bears the burden of showing that there was a flaw in what happened. So because all of those things are a bit different, it actually works fairly well, and most states have that two-part process where you have kind of the straight track of the criminal conviction, the appeal from it, and then some other collateral mechanism for reviewing that in the state courts. It may not be post-conviction. It may be something else. But typically that's what you're going to see, and it's for those reasons. Anything else you'd like to add on that?
No.
Okay.
Covered it. Thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it was already implicit in what I was saying, but I want to make clear that the right to counsel extends in the post-conviction proceeding all the way through the Court of Appeals, and again, review in the Supreme Court, which is not mandatory, it's discretionary, but the Supreme Court does have the power to review the Court of Appeals decision in the post-conviction case. And again, those are provided by statute. Now, the final layer of proceedings on this chart is what happens in federal court. By federal statute, criminal defendants can challenge their state convictions, but only on federal law grounds. The defendants in those cases are represented by federal public defenders or appointed by federal courts, and so the state does not pay for those lawyers. However, the Department of Justice still handles those cases for the state in the federal proceeding. And those begin, again, in the trial court and can proceed up to, and often do proceed, up to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then from there could be subject to United States Supreme Court review, although, again, that's exceedingly rare. Even though the state is not paying for court-appointed lawyers in those federal proceedings, the committee needs to know a few things about those proceedings just to understand the potential impact of cuts or changes to the current system, including the state post-conviction system. Generally speaking, as it stands, those state proceedings, the direct appeal and the post-conviction proceeding, limit the issues that can be raised in the later federal proceeding. If the petitioner, the person who wants to challenge his conviction in federal court, has not raised his claims, in the state court, he can't raise them in federal court. And so there's a narrowing of issues as we proceed through the system, a significant narrowing of the number of issues. Now, there's also a principle in these federal cases that federal courts have to give the state court determination of the federal law a great deal of deference. And so what that does for us is, again, narrow down the number of issues and also mean that the federal courts aren't starting from scratch and deciding for themselves whether there is a legal problem with the conviction, but instead they are looking to the state court determination and basically saying, is that patently unreasonable? And so we have a lot more... because of that, our results in the federal courts tend to depend a lot on what happens in the state court. And because our state court outcomes tend to be a little bit more uniform and predictable, we are not as surprised in the federal courts as we would be, I think, if we didn't have these state court proceedings to make those judgments in the first place. Basically, our results in state court tend to be a little bit more uniform than what we would expect to see in federal court if the cases just went straight from direct appeal into federal court. Now, I think that really does cover most of, I guess the other point that is important to make is that although, again, in the federal proceeding, the state is not paying for the defense counsel, the state is, again, paying for DOJ's expenses. And the federal public defenders tend to have a lot more in the way of resources than we do in the state. And what that would do is, if we did not have this state court proceeding to narrow down the issues and also have a state court determination to which deference has to be given, we are going to, or what we would predict is that DOJ, would find ourselves outmatched by the investigative resources of the public defenders, and so we would have to bump up our spending in order to defend those cases in the federal proceeding. I guess the point that most of this is trying to make is kind of what Mary said, and that is our concern is to make sure that this committee understands that elimination of the state post-conviction process likely would result in costs being shifted to other places in the criminal justice system, whether by shifting it to other types of state court relief or by shifting it to federal courts where, again, the state budget is still impacted because of DOJ's necessary involvement in those cases. And again, at the end of any of these proceedings, actually at any point throughout this process, if the reviewing court decides that there was an error that warrants reversal, then we end up back in the trial court again. And that involves costs, again, to the state and to the counties, as well as possibly law enforcement. And unless there are any questions about that, I think I have nothing else to add.
Great. Thanks, Jennifer.
Thank you.
Council.
Chairman of the committee, Ms. Lloyd, so what you're saying is particularly that if we abolish, which we could do, because it's only a statutory right, we could abolish both the right to counsel post-conviction relief and we could abolish the proceedings of post-conviction relief. Am I correct?
Yes. The Mr. Chair and members of the committee, the problem, though, with eliminating the post-conviction process itself is that there are federal courts or federal law dictates that state courts provide some sort of mechanism for vindicating federal rights or for correcting violations of federal rights. And so even if we didn't call it post-conviction relief, there would be a lot of other ways, requests for writs of habeas corpus, petitions for mandamus relief, other types of proceedings in which we would expect to see the same claims and expect to see the court saying these people have a right to bring these claims in these other proceedings.
And I assume because the process and procedure is not as well defined as post-conviction relief, particularly at the beginning, it would be a lot more expensive. Am I correct? Isn't habeas corpus a constitutional right?
Yes.
Right. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, one further question. We have talked before about this issue, and one thing that we have talked about as far as post-conviction relief is concerned is having the right through the trial court, but not the right to the Court of Appeals. And how would that play out as far as the limiting and narrowing of the issues for the federal process and also as it relates to our state habeas corpus proceedings?
Well, what you're asking, counsel, is whether in the post-conviction proceeding, if the judgment became final at this point after the state trial court, and whether what would happen if there were no ability for the petitioner to then seek review in the state courts. And our prediction with that is that what would happen is at this point the person would be done with the state court proceedings. However, every issue that they raised in the state court, in the state trial court, they could then proceed to litigate in federal court without the same amount of deference, and of course without the restrictions, because it invariably what happens in any of these proceedings is you start off in the trial court with any number of potential issues, and as the case moves along in the system, the issues become narrower and narrower because, of course, the lawyer or the petitioner himself realizes that some issues have more merit than others. And so what we would expect to see is the same number of issues that were raised in the state post-conviction court then being shifted over to the federal court. And again, because the federal public defenders have the investigative resources that we don't necessarily have, DOJ would end up having to spend a lot more money, or the state would have to spend a lot more money defending those cases in the federal proceeding.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Seems to me in the past, and Mr. Taylor, you'll remember, we've looked at least streamlining the process and trying to reduce cost, for instance, by requiring certification by attorneys representing parties in post-conviction relief that they've reviewed the record and that there's a colorable claim to go forward, and it seems to me some summary disposition as well by the courts. Try to speed this along and at least spend less time and less money on each of these cases. How much of those have we implemented? That has been around for sessions. How much of those of reforms have we implemented, and what effect are they having?
Mr. Chair, members of the Finney, Representative Shetterly, we have done some of that, and we do have some expedited process for resolving the post-conviction cases on appeal. We often will resolve those with the petitioner presenting their arguments, the state responding with a motion for summary affirmance if it doesn't look like there's any reason to go ahead with full briefing. That has been an effective tool for streamlining that process. We have talked about having that sort of gatekeeping motion practice at the front end. We haven't implemented it for post-conviction. Right now we're in, I think, sort of an experimental stage of having done that for the parole board orders, and that was done last session, and we're just now seeing how that process is going to work with the parole board system. What we have found so far is it hasn't resulted in what we had hoped as far as making the process more efficient. We may be able to improve on that by working with the court to try to get some of those motions actually resolved. At this point, they're backing up in the court system. So those are possibilities of some things that we can look at. And I think at this point, we want to keep a close eye on what's happening with the parole board example to see if that's going to result in any actual savings for us. If I can also respond to the question you raised, another option in looking at that is not simply to look at eliminating the appellate process entirely, but simply eliminating this last step.
Okay.
And that's something else that could be examined. There's nothing that requires both of those steps to be made available. It probably is not a significant savings for the work that's done to prepare a petition for review to the Supreme Court, but it is something that could be separated out. Have the Court of Appeals decision be the decision of last resort in those cases, which would give you that narrowing that occurs between the trial court and the appellate court, and hopefully then reduce the kinds of issues that could be raised in federal habeas, and still have some savings to the system.
Good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Can I just follow up on that, Mary? You said it could reduce the issues that could be on the federal. I mean, what else would they be able to raise at the Supreme Court review that they hadn't been required to do at the Court of Appeals.
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski, let me clarify then what I'm saying. Typically what we see is that as you go down this column, you get fewer and fewer issues. So as long as we have all parts of it, by the time we get to federal habeas, we've got a handful of issues that can be raised in federal habeas. If we eliminate this step, we'll probably have a slightly larger set of issues, because there still is a winnowing process that occurs here. But I think it would be much better than if we eliminated both steps and had all of the federal issues that were raised in the state trial post-conviction proceeding as possible issues that could be pursued in federal habeas.
I appreciate that.
Please proceed. Is Mike up next?
Mike's up next.
All right, Mike.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee counsel, my name is Michael Livingston. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Justice. My current responsibilities at the Department in the Appellate Division include supervising the termination of parental rights caseload, and I've been asked to speak to you today about the appointment of counsel requirements, both statutory and constitutional, in juvenile court dependency proceedings. With the assistance of counsel, I've submitted 3 pages of written testimony which outline, and I hope a simplified and understandable form, both the statutory and constitutional rights and requirements that apply, and I'm not going to repeat that. What I will do is explain by way of background that by juvenile court dependency, that's the juvenile court jurisdiction that's not delinquency. It's the juvenile court jurisdiction that applies when a child has been abused, neglected, or otherwise has conditions or circumstances that endanger the child's welfare. What I denominate as the jurisdictional phase of that in my written materials is the phase at which the juvenile court first decides whether court intervention is required in the case to protect the welfare of the child, and then if the juvenile court does take jurisdiction in the case, the review over the months that follow of the parent's progress toward eliminating the barriers to the safe return of the child home. After a certain period of time, no more than 14 months after the child is first placed in foster care or 12 months after the jurisdictional finding, the court holds what's called a permanency hearing. At the permanency hearing, the court decides, in effect, if there's going to be a time within the reasonable future that the child can be returned home, and if not, some alternate permanent placement plan is implemented by DHS, the Child Welfare Agency, and the court. In most cases, if that occurs, it's a termination of parental rights. And so that's the reason for the breakdown in my materials between jurisdiction and termination of parental rights. Again, I won't reiterate what is set out in the materials, but I do want to point out the order in which these rights are described in the materials. The first, under 1A, Roman numeral 1, then subheading A, discusses the right of appointed counsel in proceedings to establish jurisdiction, and then the subsections of that, how and what are the requirements for appointing for parents, and how and what are the requirements for appointing for children. Under 419B205, which applies to the parents, those standards, in essence, are the same as those required by the Due Process Clause of the United States Constitution. That is, the parent is indigent, and as you can see, the statute itself says the nature of the proceeding and due process require the appointment of that. For children, the standard is somewhat different, and I did want to point that out. For children, in the jurisdictional phase of a dependency proceeding, our current law, or ORS 419B195, requires that counsel for a child be appointed in every case under the jurisdictional phase, if requested, and if the parent, child, or guardian is indigent. So the difference between, under current law, the difference between the appointment requirements for parents and children in the jurisdictional phase is that with respect to the parent, the court takes into account the nature of the proceedings and the requirements of due process. With respect to a request for appointment of counsel for a child, that's not a consideration. So I do want to point out that that's a difference in our current statutes. For purposes of termination of parental rights, the current law requires, and this is the second page of the material, that parents be appointed counsel in a proceeding to terminate parental rights if requested, and if the parent is indigent. Again, there is no requirement that the court review the nature of the case itself and whether due process would require it. I should add to that, though, that under the requirements of due process, in almost every termination case, a good argument could be made that the requirements of due process for appointment of counsel are satisfied because of the nature of the right at issue and the complexity of the cases we see. Unless it's a case where the parent simply doesn't appear at the trial and the evidence is presented solely by the state, it's a rare case that wouldn't require or doesn't involve some complexity and cross-examination of experts, for example, in legal and substantive law questions. For children in termination of parental rights cases, the juvenile court may, but is not required, to appoint counsel. And that reflects the current constitutional requirement, too. It's decided on a case-by-case basis. And the constitutional requirements for appointment of counsel are discussed as to the parents and the children on the third and last page of the materials. The due process requirement for children is discussed in the case I've cited there, F versus C, and basically says that the due process clause does not require appointment of counsel for children in every termination case. It's again to be determined on a case-by-case basis. In the case cited there, the court gives examples of how that might arise, how that requirement might arise, and those include cases where counsel for the state and counsel for the parents together cannot, for some reason, develop an accurate record or, again, between them represent the interest of the child. And the reason you consider those together is that in a termination of parental rights proceeding, a child has two equivalent but sometimes contradictory interest. On one, the interest in having a safe and permanent home, and the other, the interest in maintaining the familial relationship with a parent. And so the thinking is between them, the state and the parent can represent those interests. I am aware, because of a copy of some testimony or a letter to the committee that I received yesterday from Angela Sherbo of the Juvenile Rights Project, that she makes the argument or the contention that children under the Due Process Clause may be required in every case to be represented by counsel, because unlike the parent, the end of the termination of parental rights case may involve a change in custody, which she equates as a change in the liberty status of the child. I can only comment on that by way of saying that's not a consideration that I've had any time to address in thought or in writing, so I can't comment on the accuracy of that observation.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Bernanke.
Mike, I'm sorry to interrupt, but I wanted to ask you, since you talked about the interest of the child, I know in the balancing the court and determining as to custody for a child, the best interest of the child, is that what this decision that you referred to attributing to as to what is in the best interest of the child? Because to me, it seems like not always are the interests of the parents going to be in the best interest of the child. And do you think that we have some duty to make certain that those interests are being fairly represented in the context for the child as compared to the parents?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, if I understand your question correctly, first of all, it is correct that the parents' presentation of case and cross-examination and challenging of the state's evidence isn't always toward the best interest of the child ultimately. By interest of the child in determining whether both the existing parties, the state and the parent, can represent the interest of the child, what I mean by that is the interest of the child in preserving those two values or interests that I talked about earlier. Number one, the child has an interest in maintaining the legal relationship with the parent. But the child also has an interest in a permanent safe home. And that's what I meant, that sometimes those interests compete. And what the judge basically has to do under the termination statute is to determine how that competition weighs out. But for the child's benefit in that proceeding, the child's interest in the fairness of the proceeding is that a full record be developed on both sides of that question. and the, a case where in which the child's interest may be not divergent from either the, both the state and the parent, but different and perhaps not adequately represented, would be a case where, for example, the parent has not been very helpful or forthcoming in cooperating with the state and the court to determine whether the Indian Child Welfare Act applies, for example. And that's an interest or right of the child, which is to follow up and see whether there is where the child is enrollable in a Native American tribe or not. That may be a separate interest that, you know, the parent may not have an interest in pursuing that, and the state may be relying on what the parent is saying. So that's an example where counsel for the child to pursue that particular interest might be appropriate or required under as a matter of due process.
Go ahead.
And that would be a decision for the judge to make as to whether, based on the evidence that's coming from those two interests, are actually fully representing, let's say, the complexity or the interest of that child.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brzezinski, that's correct. And, of course, if I could add another and perhaps more obvious example where the child may have interests or concerns that aren't developed would be where the child has a specific emotional or physical disability, which really is an issue in the termination case but may not be developed or considered fully if left to the state or the parents' attorneys.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome, Representative. Mike, maybe you could give us a sense in both situations of parent and child in these matters. What percentage of times can you give us some estimate? Because I know some counties may do it differently with respect to the appointment of someone in the case of a child. Is it almost in every case? Is it 50-50? What's the breakdown, or do you know?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a couple of different responses. First, that varies from county to county. In some counties of the state, there are hardly ever counsel appointed for children. And I should add here, too, just as something to keep in mind, that the role of the CASA, the court-appointed special advocate, which I believe is required to be appointed in every case, and the CASA's responsibility is to protect the interest of the child, too, and also to make sure that the state and the parents' lawyers are doing their respective jobs. In Multnomah County, I believe, and I think Ingrid Swenson is here from Multnomah County and probably can speak to this better than I, but I believe in almost every case, counsel is appointed to represent children in Multnomah County. I see just anecdotally, and then I've heard that that's a policy also, but I think she or someone who practices regularly up there would be the best call on that. But in general, it varies from county to county. And Multnomah is the only one that I know of where it seems to be anyway a requirement. And I should point out that that's the result or consistent with the current statute, which requires that in every jurisdictional case, if the parent is indigent, the child or parent requests, there has to be a counsel appointed.
And I want to make sure that I understood your point about the termination of parental rights and the due process requirement, but I think your point was that given the nature of the right that's at issue here, that in almost every case it would meet the due process requirement mandating appointment of counsel. Is that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I can't say that it would. What I said, and I think this is fair, that at least, at a minimum, a very good argument could be made that it would. And I use for that response the factors that I've listed on the third page from the Lassiter case,
right?
Whether there's expert testimony, the nature, for example, of whether they're complex legal or factual issues. In most of the litigated cases, which are pretty much all appealed, so I see the records in those cases, I can say, and I believe if there are lawyers here who practice represent parents on these appeals, I think they would confirm that given those factors, except unless you had a case where the parent simply didn't show up and there was nothing that could have rebutted the evidence that was presented, a good argument could be made that the due process clause would require appointment in those cases. And I also might add, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, no, my follow-up question was going to be then, if for some reason, let's just do the hypothetical, though the legislature were to change the statute,
and not require appointment and termination of parental rights under the factors that you've identified. And we were essentially left to the constitutional issues that were laid out in Lassiter. And we had cases where we went ahead and terminated a parent's right without the appointment of counsel. Explain to myself and the committee what the net effect of those costs to the system would be by not having appointed counsel.
All right, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I should say first that I think given the current trial bench in juvenile court, my sense is that most juvenile court judges would err on the side of appointing counsel.
Okay.
If it were, so if you did away with the statutory right, I think that if counsel were requested, that most judges would err on the side of appointing. But taking the hypothetical and just purely in the abstract, you would have a case where the record showed that there was no counsel appointed. And unlike cases where the issue on appeal is whether the parent had adequate counsel, which is a different issue, here the issue would be whether the parent should have had any counsel. And my sense is what would happen in those cases is if there's any question that could have been asked an expert, if there's any reasonable response or rebuttal evidence that could have been offered and usually in the past would be offered had counsel been represented, that the Court of Appeals approach to resolving that case would not be to say, based on this record we have, counsel wouldn't have made a difference unless that were absolutely clear. I think the response of the court would be to send the case back for retrial with counsel, which would obviously be an increased net cost to the system. And more importantly, I think it would delay further the resolution of the child's permanency and placement in a termination case.
And in fact, in some cases, and I haven't thought this through, but with the federal requirement that we deal with these permanency issues now under the federal guidelines with a shortened time frame, it could put us out of compliance with our requirement to get a final determination on the permanency of the child within the federal requirement. Isn't that right?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think that's exactly correct.
So again, I think the point, colleagues, that I think we're trying to all come to an understanding here is what the true costs are. I mean, you know, you could save some money by not appointing counsel on the front end, but there's a high likelihood of, you know, higher costs on the back end, having had to retry these cases, having things referred. And again, most importantly, in the aspect of termination of parental rights, to the extent that the state is taking that very strong position and doing something that is, in fact, breaking up a family by the force of law, you've got this child that's sitting out there who is going to not know, and a family not knowing what the outcome of the situation is for a lot longer period of time.
That's correct.
Okay. You have more to say, Mike?
Just a few points. I, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have a couple of observations, if I may, where there might be some economies which don't involve changing the substantive law. And they're somewhat obvious, but just by chance, if they don't appear so, I'd like to point them out anyway for the record. The first is in the scrutiny which is given the application for indigency, and I cannot say, because I have no data either way to say that one county or more than one county is or isn't doing an adequate job in reviewing the applications for indigency. But it seems to me that that's certainly something that could be looked at. In other words, what is the process for reviewing the application for indigency? How much do we follow that up? And the other thing is, do we lump parents in juvenile cases who apply for appointed counsel in with the same process that we use for criminal defendants? I'm not sure how that works in the system, but I think that's one place that there may be some economies. The other, if you look at footnote 1 on the second page, refers to a statute, 419B198, which authorizes the court to recoup all or part of the costs of counsel for a child from the parent or from the guardian of the estate of the child, if there is one. I don't know whether and if so, to what extent courts are doing that. I don't know, for example, whether courts are assuming that there's no water in the well, so there's no reason to lower the bucket. But it seems to me that there is at least something that ought to be checked off as doable or not before any consideration of changes in the substantive law are made. Finally, I do want to point out, though, that the statute for appointment of counsel to children in the jurisdictional phase, which requires it in every case without regard to the nature and circumstances of the case, is broader than is required by the due process clause. And while I personally and as a member of the department would not say that the legislature or the state standard should only be what's required by the Constitution, I do think there may be some room again for adjustment in the substantive law in that case. I assume that you will have people presenting testimony to you who represent children in these cases, and I can say by my own experience that they do an excellent job and help us in many cases resolve a case in an appropriate way and do a very good job. But I do feel it's my obligation to point out that is an anomaly somewhat in the statute.
Okay. Thank you. Any further questions before we bring up the next panel? Okay. Thank you very
much
for your information. Very important. Now we're going to have Peter Ozan, who is the new Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. With him is Mr. Barnes Ellis, who is the Chairman of the Public Defense Services Commission. Did I get that right?
You did.
The title right? Public Defense Services Commission. And Ann Christian, who is the Director of Indigent Defense Services Division of the Judicial Branch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Peter Ozan. As of January 2nd of this year, I'm the Executive Director of the Office of Public Defense Services. And in deference to your time, I think we can be brief. I did want to introduce first my boss and then a soon-to-be colleague. And Chairman Williams has already introduced Barnes Ellis, a senior partner at Stoll Reeves, chairman of what I think of as a board of directors of the Office of Public Defense Services. And Mr. Ellis came because I think I can speak for him and for myself in saying that we appreciate the attention that the committee is giving to indigent defense. We are prepared to answer any questions, of course, now or work with the committee in exploring matters of concern to the committee. Before I go further, I want to introduce, as you all know, Ann Christian, who is director of the Indigent Defense Services Division in the Judicial Branch. As of July, we hope, with some pending legislation, or at least October, there will be a merger between Ann Christian's contracting function of trial lawyers throughout the state, along with the current office, which represents state appellate defenders, into one system responsive to a board of directors and hopefully responsive to the legislature in terms of managing indigent defense. With regard to the specific issues before you now, that is to chart out the substantive scope or parameters of the right to counsel, Ann and I met with our friends in the Department of Justice. We want to express the fact that we'll be willing to cooperate with them on these matters when we can. And we agreed on the presentation today, and I don't believe I have really anything to add in terms of the scope of the right to counsel. We'll certainly respond to questions. I know you'll be looking forward to Ann Christian's discussion of the budgetary aspects, which are very important, I know, to all of us with regard to indigent defense. I think briefly, the only other addition I would add, and so many of you are lawyers, or those of you who aren't have been in court in various aspects and seen proceedings, no doubt, in which a party with a right to be before the court, to have a jury trial, to express their rights to habeas corpus, without a lawyer, whether it's civil or criminal, creates a mess for courts and parties. And I think the attorney, the Department of Justice representatives expressed that in terms of the difficulty of proceeding with an efficient justice system without the aid of counsel. And I think that's something that the courts don't always discuss, but is always lurking there. So, for example, post-conviction relief, as Representative Crummell appropriately asked about that function, if there is a constitutional right to habeas corpus, as there has been in most states, defendants with that right
will assert habeas corpus on their own through state and federal processes, and history has shown that that process of asserting that constitutional right in the absence of a coherent process like post-conviction and without counsel essentially forces the courts into almost a breakdown of dealing with those cases. They're unmanageable without some kind of a process and lawyers. So I think that, and that came out earlier, and I believe that's really the only point I have to add. So unless there are other questions, I think we will move on to the budget.
Representative Prozanski.
I want to ask if it wouldn't be appropriate for Mr. Ozan to maybe discuss some of his background. I've had the opportunity to work with Peter on many things. I think it would be advantageous for the rest of the committee who have not had that opportunity to know his background, what he's coming in with as to his perspective and his practice previously.
Sure, please, Peter.
Mr. Chair, Representative Prozanski. I've always enjoyed Representative Prozanski's participation in my law school classes, which I still teach from time to time. In fact, I believe that one of those we had judges who I often have to my classes who were at one time or another students of mine. So it's concerning to. Well, I came to Oregon in 1974 and soon became a member of the University of Oregon law faculty specializing in criminal law and worked with the development of sentencing guidelines. I worked with Governor Neil Goldschmidt on staff dealing with issues of corrections, the development of sentencing guidelines, the construction of prisons, and the strengthening of community corrections. So I became knowledgeable, I think, about the issues of corrections as well as criminal justice. I started out my career as a public defender in California before I came to Oregon. In 1982, you remember the economic times were similar to this. My wife and I left Oregon and went to Palo Alto, California, where I became a lawyer in a high technology firm. In 1985, I returned to Oregon, as I say, worked for Governor Goldschmidt. After that, joined a private law firm in Portland. And I guess I skipped something there. It's been 30 years now. For 10 years, I was a professor at the University of Oregon Law School. I was partner in Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt in Portland for 10 years, and during that time I was chairman of the Public Safety Coordinating Council, which you're all familiar with and which allowed me to stay active in criminal defense and public policy and public safety issues. In 1998, Attorney General Reno and then U.S. Attorney Chris Olson asked me to become chief counsel to the United States Attorney in Oregon and to head up a gun violence project to address youth gun violence in Portland and four other cities throughout the country. And I know some of you joined me in a trip to Boston where we looked at how Boston had addressed youth gun violence, and for 3 years I worked on that project. And with a change of administration, I looked around, would I go back to corporate law practice or do something else? And this opportunity came up, and it was an opportunity I felt that I could be of service to the state. And I look forward to working with all the good people on the commission, in the legislature, and both with prosecutors and the defense bar.
Thank you. Yes, Mr. Ellis.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, the commission conducted a national search to find the right person for executive director. We had applications from all over, and frankly we were very, very pleased that we were able to find Peter Ozan, who happens to be a very distinguished person here in our own state, willing to move from the work he's been doing to take on this job. So from the commission's point of view, we're very excited about this. It's been a high moment for us.
And if I could just point out what some of the members on the committee who haven't followed this issue closely in the last few years in the legislature, we did establish a transition to a public, essentially a public defense services commission, which will oversee all of the indigent defense issues statewide. That, by a change we made, I think actually during one of the legislative sessions, will become effective on June 30, July 1, isn't that right?
Mr. Chair, it's currently scheduled for October, but we have introduced a pre-filing bill to make the full integration effective July 1.
Right, and that's still something we'll have to act on then. but it will make it July 1 so to coincide with essentially the beginning of the new biennium, so we don't have the carryover of the old system into a portion of the new biennium. But it's a substantial change in statewide management of these issues that the previous legislature has essentially acted on and that we'll get to be involved in as it makes that transition and the finishes and touches are made. Before you go into the budget briefly, Ann, I want to point out to the committee that also in your materials is a copy of a memorandum from Virginia Vanderbilt. You remember Virginia, who was here a few minutes ago from Legislative Council, which she authored to us at my request back in May, that talked about Oregon's obligation both under the, I think it's already been passed out. I think everybody's got it. Both the right, essentially the constitutional right to appointment of counsel and gives the current sort of view of our Legislative Council's office on what that is. I don't know that you want to take a lot of time on that, Ann, but it might not be a bad idea to take just a couple of minutes and sort of point out generally the source of this issue for some of the new members of the committee who may be a little less familiar with sort of where this all springs from.
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to. For the record, my name is Ann Christian. I've been the director of Indigent Defense Services Division, which is a division within the State Court Administrator's Office, Judicial Department, for the past 14 years. And before I do mention a few things in addition to what the first panel indicated with regard to the right to court-appointed counsel, two things. Mr. Chair and members, I greatly appreciate the time, the attention, and the review that this Judiciary Committee is taking of the state's public defense system, especially early on in session. It truly is appreciated. And the second thing is the chair of the Public Defense Services Commission indicated that from the commission's point of view, Peter Ozan is, I'm changing the term, but a godsend for public defense. And from the standpoint of my staff and myself as the current director, we couldn't be happier with having Mr. Ozan on board. And we've had the opportunity over the past biennium to do a lot of transition work. So we fully expect that even with extremely, extremely limited resources, that the transition of what used to be the State Public Defender's Office and the larger with regard to workload and expenses Indigent Defense Program will be hopefully seamless. So to address the issue, Mr. Chair, prior to getting into the budget as far as right to counsel, the first panel who presented information, I have absolute agreement as the administrator of the Indigent Defense Program as far as my understanding of what the constitutional and statutory right to counsel is. As the director, I frequently get questions, misperceptions, myths, I might call them, about what the right to counsel involves. And so what I've provided to you is just a report that I prepared, and it was way back, time flies, in 1994 at the request of then Representative Kevin Mannix. It's a report to the November E-Board. And I don't expect you to read it, but since I understand this committee will be spending some time on the issue of indigent defense, it's a handy resource if we do get into particular issues or bills that are coming forward to do away with the right to counsel. And one of the things in that report I've updated for you today is just a yellow sheet of paper that shows the types of cases for which the state of Oregon provides a right to court-appointed counsel. And to individuals who are not involved in the indigent defense system, sometimes people are surprised that only 52% of the workload of indigent defense is for criminal cases. And so this information is intended to give you an idea of what all the constitutions of both the United States and the state and your current statutes with regard to court-appointed counsel provide. Now, I mentioned sometimes there are some myths. One of the about the only change since 1994 is the fact that the United States Supreme Court did resolve an issue that was a very big issue for the state of Oregon, and that's the right to counsel, appointed counsel, with respect to what I'll call a minor misdemeanor. a misdemeanor where the person may not actually go to jail. And about 9 months ago now, the United States Supreme Court issued an opinion that basically said that Oregon's standard as far as right to court-appointed counsel, even in those minor misdemeanors, is the federal standard. That's having an incredible impact on many states where they had operated under the constitutional assumption that there was no right to court-appointed counsel if a person actually did not go to jail. So that's about the only update since 1994 of significance. And the only other handout I've given to you that is kind of follow-up to the first presenters is, it's violet or purple. The issue, Mr. Chair, came up as far as indigency. This one-page sheet deals with two issues related to public defense. The first is what you've already heard about, the breadth of cases in which counsel is appointed to those people who are determined indigent by the court, and it ranges from criminal proceedings, which most people think of as public defense, to the child abuse and neglect cases that Mr. Livingston addressed you on. That's been one of our fastest-growing caseloads in the past 14 years I've been director. We're up to about 20% of our total caseload. We have probation violation. We have delinquency, civil commitment. We have had an increase in those cases with some of the mental health issues. And I guess I'll just take a moment to say there are so many interplays between the mental health system, Department of Human Services, the courts, and indigent defense, and finally post-conviction relief and habeas corpus that you heard about. But I bring this up because there were some issues that were brought up during the first panel's presentation with regard to financial eligibility. So you've heard about what types of cases does a person is a person entitled to appointed counsel, but who is indigent? What does indigent mean? And the Oregon statutory standard is exactly the same as what the federal constitution requires. And so Oregon adopted exactly what the federal constitution requires, which is put in this piece of paper to say a person is indigent if the person is determined to be financially unable to retain adequate counsel without substantial hardship in providing basic economic necessities to the person or the person's dependent family. With that said, as was indicated, the state court administrator's office in which I work has to come up with the rules as far as how to interpret this statute so that every day in the courts a judge can actually decide, has this standard been met? And so what we've done is we've established an indigency verification program. And to boil it down, it's really a two-step process. If an individual is in court, let's say today, on a charge of driving under the influence of intoxicants, because of limited court resources and because it seems to make some sense, we have said as part of our rules that if an individual qualifies for food stamps, federal food stamps, there is a presumption that that person could not go out and hire an attorney without causing this substantial hardship to himself, herself, and dependents. But a court, if there are assets available, can always override that presumption. So if I'm in court today and I don't qualify for food stamps, but let's say I'm working minimum wage, the final step of the two-prong test is whether or not I have sufficient money or assets to go out and retain counsel. So to implement that prong of the indigency determination, we've set standards as far as the cost of retaining counsel. And for those of you who are attorneys, this may help you. The current standard for driving under the influence of intoxicants, which is not, it is a felony if it's your fourth, but a misdemeanor, is $750. So we have not really, we don't believe at least, set standards that are particularly high. It would be difficult, quite frankly, to find counsel, retain counsel at $750 for a DUII. With that said, we've set our indigency rate at 130% of the federal poverty rate. I have checked with some Department of Human Services guidelines as far as assistance, state assistance to individuals who don't have sufficient money, and they range from 185% of the federal poverty line. So I hope I've given you a little bit about information about the determination of indigence. The final thing I'll say, and then I'll move to budget, is the fact that, and Representative Przanski, you may remember this, in 1989 we started one of the things that I'm most proud about with the Indigent Defense Program, and that's an indigency verification program where there are actually court staff whose, until recently, sole responsibility was to verify the indigency of people and actually get employment records and check property tax rolls and that type of thing. And we have had a nationally recognized program, and I guess people still do nationally recognize it. They just don't know that because of the shortfalls in the court's budgets, and these are court employees, that that program really is being decimated as we speak. So it's one of those system issues that was brought up with the first group. I certainly understand the court situation as far as what's needed to move cases along, but the interaction of all the different players, the fact that we are losing verification staff simply means that we're back to the pre-1989 situation where a judge who is trying to get through an arraignment very quickly or trying to get through a juvenile dependency first hearing is looking at this detailed two-page affidavit of indigence and making a determination on the spot whether or not the person qualifies for counsel. So it's a huge loss in my mind. With regard to...
Yes,
before we go to the budget, Ann, you gave us a case that the U.S. Supreme Court that's basically upheld as to when attorneys have to be appointed. And the standard, if I heard you correctly, is if they could potentially go to jail?
Correct.
Is that cited in the material? Because the thing that caught me off guard is when you said minor misdemeanors. I've always attributed misdemeanors are ones that someone is potentially could go to jail as compared to a violation. Where it is only a monetary fine can be imposed. And I didn't know if you were trying to make a distinction of certain type of misdemeanors that maybe I'm just not familiar with that are just fine only as compared to potentially jail.
Mr. Chair and Representative Przanski, let me clarify because I kind of ran through that. Number one, your question with regard to whether the fairly recent United States Supreme Court citation is in the materials. When Virginia Vanderbilt's memo was sent out, the cover memo included the citation to the United States Supreme Court case. It is not in Virginia's memo because that opinion was issued, I think it was within 2 weeks of her memo, but it's Shelton versus Alabama.
Okay, thank you.
And we can provide you that opinion. To clarify my reference to minor misdemeanor, that probably was not the best way to explain it. Prior to the United States Supreme Court decision, there were Supreme Court decisions that suggested, clearly suggested, that an individual charged with a misdemeanor, forget I said minor misdemeanor, so long as that individual did not go to jail, there's no right to court-appointed counsel. So over the past, 14 years that I've been here, we've had this issue in Oregon about the assumption that Oregon has a broader right to counsel in criminal cases than the federal Constitution requires. And that appeared to be the case until recently. And what was difficult was if the standard is, if I don't go to jail, then I don't receive court-appointed counsel, is how does one know at the beginning of the case whether I'm going to go to jail? And so that was, I think, why I kind of abbreviated and said minor misdemeanor. Many of us know there are misdemeanor offenses, especially for first-time offenders, where it's pretty safe bet for property misdemeanors, first offense, that, say, a college student in your hometown is not going to go to jail if he or she is convicted. This is what happened in the U.S. Supreme Court case, is didn't go to jail, was placed on probation. And this is typical. Placed on probation with conditions, don't get in trouble again, pay a fine, be good, and in 2 years you're off probation. You have a criminal record, but you're off probation. In the U.S. Supreme Court case, it was an individual who received no jail time, put on probation, and then didn't follow through with the probation, found himself before the court, the state court in Alabama, obviously, and the court said, you're going to jail now because you didn't comply with your probation. The Supreme Court fairly recently held that even though that person didn't go to jail originally, the fact that he was on probation, he should have originally had court-appointed counsel, and you can imagine what's going on in other states who had not taken that approach. So now it appears that Oregon, with regard to criminal cases, is pretty much in sync with the federal constitution, or vice versa, maybe. With regard to the two topics that specifically on your agenda I was going to address, one is the indigent defense budget. With that regard, I often find that individuals are interested in where does the money go. So currently the biennial appropriation for all of, and the minute I say all of public defense, I have to back up, for that which I'm responsible, the indigent defense program, everything except Mr. Ozan's Office of Public Defense Services, they do criminal appeals. But the current allocation for indigent defense is about $141 million. So that gives you some idea of how large it is. Of that $141 million, about three-quarters of that amount goes for legal representation provided by public defenders or law firms who are under contract with the state, your small business people and your communities. So three-quarters of that $141 million will be going to contractors. My other topic is to address the budget deficit situation, and I'll do that in a moment. But we have 89 contracts. None of public defense with regard to what we provide is by state employees. It's all by private contractors who are small business people in your community. And we're at the point where we are now reducing the contracts on an average of about 50% because of the budget reduction. So it's a significant amount of money of the $141 million that goes to contracts. About 9%. So the big amount, if you want to cut expenses, is for contracts. And these are the people who are representing people in the trial courts every day, all the time. 9% goes for non-contract representation. So these would be, again, to use Representative Przanski's district as an example. In Lane County, we have a public defender, nonprofit group of attorneys who cannot take any other work. They are dedicated only to indigent defense work. Because they get breaks as far as their malpractice insurance and that type of thing. But there is a public defender who handles the majority of the criminal cases. We have a contract with a juvenile group of attorneys who handle the dependency cases that you've heard about. And then we have a need on occasion for conflict coverage where neither one of those entities. So these would be the attorneys that Mr. Reamer will be talking about in a minute, I believe, who take a case on a case-by-case basis. So about 9% of our costs go for those expenses. And then there are what I call non-attorney expenses. Those are sometimes referred to as extraordinary expenses. They're for investigators. They're for experts. They're for interpreters for the increasing number of non-English-speaking clients who are coming through the court. So out of that total budget, about 9% for non-death penalty cases goes for those extraordinary expenses. death penalty expenses are about 7% of the total budget. So with that said, the big ticket item are all the contracts that we have out there covering all these cases for which there is a right to counsel. Quick history, we, as I said, currently are funded at a level of $141 million. That's about $1.5 million more than indigent defense was appropriated during the prior biennium. Our appropriation last biennium was $139 million, and with a recent emergency board appropriation of $5 million, at least now we're not in a position where we're funded at a level less than the last biennium. I think there may be, one of the things I'd mentioned before are myths, and I do want to get this out, is 6 months jail. You know, I frequently hear, why are we appointing counsel? And I know I digress, but I told Bill I'd make sure I made this point. People say, why are we appointing, the state of Oregon is appointing counsel to represent individuals when, you know, they'll only serve 3 months in jail, or it's a Class B misdemeanor. The most they could get is 6 months. It's a myth, and it's a common misunderstanding, but that 6 month is tied to your right to jury trial. So I just wanted to make sure on the record, you know, that that's made clear, that the United States Supreme Court has said in any criminal proceeding, not just 6 months jail. So back to the budget. I'm sorry. I wanted to make sure, and when Bill got up, it reminded me that I promised I would address that. So the budget is currently barely more than the prior biennium, and we find ourselves in the situation, although we are very, very grateful that the emergency board recently allocated $5 million that had been earmarked during the third special session. We remain in a situation where we face the potential of not having counsel available. And that is presented in the blue handout that I won't take a lot of time with you because this is not a pitch for more money. This is to provide you information as far as what happens when a part of the system, whether it be the criminal justice system or the child welfare dependency system, whether it's the Attorney General's office that is insufficiently funded or whether it's indigent defense, one of the things that happens, and I hope Amy Holmes-Hain will be here from the Multnomah DA's office, is that there's an adverse impact on another part of the system. In Multnomah currently, the is she here? Yeah, good. I'll let her talk, but there's a number of public safety issues that are kind of lurching along. And the Multnomah District Attorney's Office most recently has taken a significant budget reduction that's having an effect in Multnomah County on all of the other system players. So what the Chief Justice has had to do with the fact that indigent defense also has a projected deficit is determine what to do under those circumstances. And one thing that was considered was simply continuing and running out of money. In other words, continue with all those cases for which there's a mandate for appointment of counsel, and the money would run out April 1, as opposed to taking some action to reduce the workload. And the chief, if you have a chance to look at this, has taken the position of what we call a glide path, dealing with not hitting the wall, not waiting till April 1, and quite frankly having worst disaster on one's hands with death penalty cases pending, going without counsel. And so the actual plan is set forth as far as what cases indigent defense will not be able to handle and when on the third page of this handout. We have a date now that is not changing under any circumstances except changes in the whole public safety system that may have a positive impact on indigent defense needs, like the Multnomah DA's situation. It's a plan where we believe still it will need to be implemented March 1, and basically there will be no counsel available for new cases March 1 in certain misdemeanor, non-person. We've tried one of the key components of the chief's and his committee work is that public safety have the highest priority. So when you, if you have a chance to look at that chart, I hope it's apparent that we have concentrated on having counsel not available in the, quote, least, and this is hard to even say, but least serious with regard to public safety. And I'd like to conclude just by saying that my staff and I are always available. If you have questions directly or if you have constituents, whether they be the contractors who were currently in the process of renegotiating their contracts or whether they're individuals who are involved in the system, we're always available to answer questions.
Are there any questions for Ann?
Mr. Chair, yeah. Are we going to have the possibility to have Ann come back? I know we're on a time frame here. To maybe go over some of this. I had some questions I don't want to belabor at this point.
Sure. I'd encourage you to, obviously, if you've got questions, work with them directly. We're going to have a much longer discussion about indigent defense issues generally later in the session. In about a month, actually, we're going to set aside a couple of hearing days to talk about some of this. And we'll continue to be updated as to the impact. Obviously, the measure failing or passing, Measure 28, is going to have some impact. If you look at that report, you'll see the kind of cases and the difference in the glide path that would be affected. But I think it is very instructive for members to look at the list of crimes by the Chief Justice's order that won't be prosecuted during that period of time. And many of them, obviously are non-person, and we would call them less serious, but I don't, really little letters on the word less. I'm sure Representative Barker, as a retired law enforcement officer, looked at that list, and these are exactly the kind of crimes that cause people to really doubt their safety in a community if they can't be prosecuted. So thank you very much.
You're
appreciate
welcome.
The panel very much. I'm next going to ask George Reamer to come forward and make his remarks.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is George Reamer, and I'm Deputy Director and General Counsel of the Oregon State Bar. I have a little handout for you. Kind of goes into the general topic of the duty of Oregon lawyers to provide free legal representation to indigent defendants. And I'm just going to highlight a few points in the materials, and I'm certainly available to answer any questions that you might have. Just as a little bit of background, the Oregon State Bar does have aspirational standards for pro bono, i.e. free legal services. The aspirational standards basically encourage Oregon lawyers to provide 80 hours annually of pro bono work, 20 to 40 hours involving the direct provision of legal services to the poor without the expectation of compensation. And the 20 to 40 hours also has kind of been parsed out to include or potentially include two cases. So instead of the 20 to 40 hours, you could do two cases to satisfy that aspirational standard. Effective with the 2004 Oregon State Bar membership dues statement, we are going to be asking all bar members to voluntarily report their pro bono work for that year, and so we hope to have some better figures as to the overall contributions that lawyers provide through their pro bono efforts. But one statistics that I can provide you that is from our new lawyers division, they did a pro bono challenge during the year 2001, and they gathered data that represented 21,000 hours of work by lawyers through that program, 16,000 hours by lawyers, 5,000 hours by law students, with a total estimated value of $3.1 million. And I think pro bono is most often understood as free civil legal services to the poor, but it does not necessarily include criminal defense work, but I think the concept certainly includes both categories. Now, interestingly, in Oregon, we have a specific statute that is in the Bar Act that basically says that a lawyer shall never reject for any personal consideration the cause of the defenseless or the oppressed. Theoretically, a lawyer could be disciplined by the Oregon Supreme Court for violating this statute. My research indicates that this statute was first adopted in Oregon in 1862, but I've not found any judicial interpretation. I have found almost the identical language in other state statutes, including California's Business and Professions Code, but I really haven't gotten to the bottom of whether or not there are any California cases that expand on that duty either. There's also a constitutional provision in Oregon, Article 1, Section 18, that says in part that the particular services of any man may not be demanded by the state without just compensation. That's a fairly unique verbiage. There are few jurisdictions that have that identical verbiage, and I think ours came from Indiana, the Indiana Constitution. I believe Tennessee and a few other states have that unique language. Whether a mandatory court-appointed counsel system could or would violate this provision is really an open question. And I guess the framework that would surround this discussion is if you ran out of money and you wanted or needed court-appointed case lawyers, could you not conscript general bar members to provide the service by appointment of the courts? And then the question would be, would such a conscription system essentially violate this constitutional provision because you would be demanding the particular services of these lawyers without necessarily paying them just compensation? My research indicates that there is one case in Oregon that did address this challenge under Article 1, Section 18, and it's briefly explained in my materials. It's a case called Keene versus Jackson County, a Court of Appeals case from 1970. And on a very summarily decided basis, the Oregon Court of Appeals rejected a lawyer's claim that the compensation that he received in handling an indigent defense case was inadequate. The argument that this violated Article 1, Section 18 was rejected. There are several other Oregon cases that seem to indicate that absent legislation providing for the expenditure of public funds to compensate lawyers for their services, they are expected to serve when requested without remuneration. And I've indicated those cases in the materials. Now, the constitutionality of any such system, I think, would really revolve around the following factors: how appointments were made, the burdens that they would impose on particular lawyers, the compensation paid, if anything, whether costs would be reimbursed, the exemptions that might apply. For example, judges are lawyers, government lawyers are lawyers. Would we apply the duty that might be imposed by such a system on all lawyers, or would certain categories of lawyers be exempted? And then safeguards to ensure that whatever system was devised resulted in the provision of competent counsel, competent representation. As outlined in my attachments, the attachments to my materials, courts in a number of jurisdictions have invalidated these private bar conscription systems or required that the systems increase compensation to avoid the takings issues that I've mentioned under Article 1, Section 18. A few jurisdictions, New Jersey, for example, and the case is cited in my materials, do have conscription systems for private bar involvement, and the courts there have upheld the constitutionality of those systems. So in conclusion, we have a statutory duty in Oregon to essentially never reject for any personal consideration the cause of the defenseless or the oppressed, and that would certainly seem to indicate that there should be some active bar involvement in making sure that indigents do receive competent representation. The exact parameters of that duty are not well defined. There is a constitutional issue that I've mentioned under Article 1, Section 18, and also under the U.S. Constitution. And then there would be the whole question of redirecting our system in the manner that would really be like a 180 from what I think we've been working very hard on in Oregon over many years, to essentially have a commission and a system that is integrated and takes into consideration all of the factors that Mr. Ozan and Ann had described. So I think the kind of sum and substance of the comments that I would provide is that theoretically it's possible. The constitutionality, I think, would be very problematic. I think this could likely be tied up in court for many years, arguing about whether this is or isn't permitted. It would generate, I think, an incredible amount of ill will. This was attempted in Nevada at one time. The Board of Governors of the State Bar of Nevada kind of launched a proposal to require, I think, 20 hours of pro bono service by all members of the Nevada State Bar. And when that was released, the bar went, you know, ballistic, and they withdrew that. The only other state that I've understand that this issue had come up was Texas, where the Texas State Bar was sued by indigents under the argument that the lawyers, the Texas Bar, and the Texas Supreme Court had the obligation to provide indigent representation. And the Texas Supreme Court said that the district court, which would be like our circuit court, did not have jurisdiction over that dispute, so they dismissed it. And then they took the issue under advisement, and I don't think anything ever came of it, to impose to impose that requirement on Texas lawyers.
Huh.
I do mention in my materials that a number of bars have, two bars have mandatory reporting of your pro bono, and I'm not aware, except in the two instances that I've mentioned from Nevada and Texas, that any state bar has a conscription or kind of like a mandatory pro bono requirement, though New Jersey is the one state that does appear, and I think there are a few others that do actually conscript lawyers to provide representation in the criminal context. So I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have. That's kind of an overview.
Yeah.
And I hope that's a benefit.
Well, it is a benefit, because certainly in the situation where we're reducing the number of cases that are likely to be appointed based on the budget, this is often brought up as the solution. Let's just start appointing lawyers. And I think you've identified that, like many of the solutions to problems in this building, it's always a little more complicated than simply sort of saying the words.
Correct.
We appreciate that. Representative Barker, do you have a question?
Yeah, just, Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say, it seemed to me that when Neil Goldschmidt was governor, they first proposed that a mandatory, people have quickly pointed out the folly of that, that, you know, you appoint a tax lawyer to defend me for stealing, is this what would work, and the amount of pro bono work that Oregon attorneys already do on their own. So,
correct.
But that was brought up. They were going to require so many hours, or the plan was to require so many hours as part of the bar licensing, but it just quickly, under just the briefest of scrutiny, just fell apart.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barker, yes, I think this has been discussed periodically over the course of time. I mean, the needs are incredible, both in the civil and the criminal area.
Right.
I think we've done a legal needs study in the civil area. It shows really maybe 25% of the people that do qualify for civil legal services get those services. So the bar has been trying to ratchet up its involvement, encourages lawyers to provide 80 hours. The bar in the broader bar, has including active participation by the Oregon State Bar, has contributed to the campaign for equal justice, which is generating a tremendous amount of money to help provide funds for the legal aid programs, which is on the civil side.
Right.
So it's a huge issue, both across the spectrum, and it is quite complex. Thank you.
Yes, Representative Cromwell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question with regards to fees. I'm just curious, when a lawyer takes a case for indigent defense, if he normally would charge, say, $100 an hour, what would he receive in terms of compensation? Obviously not in a conscripted type of situation, but in a willingness type of situation, says, yes, I'll defend this person. What kind of fees will that lawyer expect to receive?
Mr. Chair, Ms. Representative Krimmel, I'll turn that over to Ann because I think she has the answer right off the tip of her tongue.
Mr. Chair and Representative Krimmel, for the non-contract, the case-by-case appointments for lawyers, it's $40 per hour. That's for non-death penalty cases, so Measure 11, anything down. $55 per hour is for death penalty case representation. For the contractors, and I just had a need to look at this the other day, so I'm pretty certain I can say this. Under the contracts, and we have some attorneys under contract who specialize in doing death penalty work. We found that to be pretty darn efficient. The highest rate is about $91 per hour for death penalty contract work. In Central Oregon in Bend, and this is the one I recently had to look at, we have a public defender and another contractor there, and the public defender's office gets about $54 per hour. They have investigators on staff. That's part of the difference. And the other contractor, I believe, was $47 per hour. So our contractors are a little bit higher than the case-by-case attorneys, and that's in part because we like to try to have many contractors there so we don't have hourly billing. And I won't go into that today.
Yeah, and Mr. Crum, Representative Crum, I'll just to draw you the comparison, and I don't want to embarrass Mr. Joseph by asking him specifically, but a new lawyer starting out at Bullivant-Hauser bills at about what rate would you suspect?
I would say the lowest rate is probably going to be about $135.
For that's a brand new first-year lawyer. That rate would probably be fairly consistent at a law firm like mine. After 4 or 5 years, it's not uncommon to have a lawyer in my firm billing somewhere in the neighborhood of $175 to $200 an hour on matters that are a whole lot less significant than a death penalty case. And Mr. Ellis at Stoll Reeves, I suspect it's somewhere in that same range for a brand new lawyer. Yeah. So, I mean, this is by standards, it's quite a difference.
Might I ask, Ann, what's the federal?
The rate for federal court, and someone in the back will correct me, it went up. It's 95.
Right. Hope that's helpful. Well, we ran a little long today. I appreciate everyone's patience. We will go ahead and adjourn the committee for the day. We'll see you all here tomorrow at 3 o'clock.